Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 9th Saturday reading of the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today we will be reading the following main articles. School boards across the state gather for convention, hold public meetings at luxurious Colorado Springs Resort. By Kristen O. Sentinel, Colorado. Appeals Court. Aurora Council illegally blocks censure of member in closed-door meeting. By Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. El Tepehan to close after 45 years in Inglewood. By Elizabeth Slay. Littleton Academy revived for 2024. By Nina Joss. Centennial Artists Collective aims to increase visibility through holiday market. By Taylor Shaw. Xcel Energy Transformer explodes near downtown Littleton. By Nina Joss. And following up with miscellaneous articles. School boards across the state gather for convention, hold public meetings at luxurious Colorado Springs Resort. Aurora, school board directors and superintendents from across the state are gathering at the Broadmoor Hotel this week for their annual convention. Drawing criticism from open meeting advocates and government spending critics. The Colorado Association of School Boards 83rd Convention began Thursday and will go until Saturday. It's the 60th year of it being held at the hotel, according to the CSAB Executive Director, Jubal Yeni. The hotel is billed as one of the most luxurious hotel resorts in the state. The hotel claims to be the longest-running Forbes 5-star AAA 5-diamond resort in the world. Cherry Creek School District and Aurora Public Schools school board directors were among dozens of other school board officials attending the convention. Both districts are also among those that are holding public meetings at the Broadmoor, about 70 miles from the community they serve. Colorado open meeting laws do not dictate where meetings of public bodies must be held, only that they are open to the public if public business is discussed. Critics of remote meetings say that conducting public business so far from the area the local government serves defeats the purpose of a public meeting. The school district community has a right to know what school board members are discussing at a study session far from district boundaries, said Jeff Roberts, executive director of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition. Cherry Creek held an hours-long study session Wednesday morning ahead of the convention. The Sentinel sent a reporter to observe a portion of the meeting. School officials discussed the district's audits, budget and ongoing litigation regarding the state's universal preschool program, among other topics. The study session, like all of the other public meetings, was not broadcast or video recorded. Cherry Creek has recently been criticized publicly for not live streaming their board meetings like other large Colorado school districts. They do, however, upload an audio recording of the meeting after it has ended. This was often a topic of discussion during the last election cycle, when two challengers said they would advocate for live streaming of meetings. Incumbents Ann Egan and Angela Garland, who both won re-election, said that they would be open to live streaming the meetings, but acknowledged that their board meetings are not held in a central location. The school board could and should live stream the meeting, even though it's not required to do so by the law, Roberts said. Cherry Creek spokesperson Abby Smith said that the district typically conducts its December study session at the Broadmoor during the conference. Boulder Valley School District and Jeffco Public Schools also held meetings on Wednesday at the Broadmoor, according to the district's calendars. The latter organized a retreat for new board members. APS will also be having a retreat at the Broadmoor Hotel, but it is not scheduled until Sunday, the day after the convention ends. Critics say the optics and actual expense of holding school district events and conferences at what is billed as an opulent resort is troublesome to much of the public. John Caldara, president of the Independence Institute, a political commentary columnist for the Colorado Springs Gazette and host of Devil's Advocate on public television, criticized the cost of attending the conference and staying at the hotel as school districts are faced with funding problems. I am thrilled that CSAB has the elegance, style, and sophistication to meet at the Broadmoor, as I'm certain they expect Colorado school board members to have the same opulent mindset when they return to their home districts and cry poverty to their taxpayers, Caldera said. The Broadmoor is a state treasure, but that doesn't mean taxpayers' treasure should be spent there. All Cherry Creek and APS board directors are attending the convention and staying at the hotel, which is paid for by the district. APS spokesperson Corey Christensen said that the CSAB conference is a good opportunity for the board to conduct its own training in addition to the training provided by the CASB. Yenny said that the Broadmoor offers special pricing for the convention. It's actually less expensive to be here than in any place else, like all those places in Denver, he said. He added he was unable to provide an apples-to-apples estimate on costs for other venues, but the Broadmoor's partnership with CASB goes back to the decades-long relationships between the organization and the hotel. He also said that people have grown accustomed to coming to the Broadmoor. Convention pricing for Broadmoor rooms during the event start at $212 per night, plus taxes, and range to about $300 a night, plus taxes. Parking is extra, between $25 and $35 a day, according to the CASB convention website. Published rates for those rooms, posted earlier in the week on the hotel website booking page, showed rooms ranging from $255 a night to $400 a night. Pricing at nearby hotels in Colorado Springs, according to the convention website, varies. At Marriott Hotel, located about 2 miles away from the Broadmoor, the room rates are $110 per night. At the Cheyenne Mountain Resort, less than 2 miles from the Broadmoor, standard room rates are $145 per night. Nightly rates for some hotels near the downtown convention center, such as the Hyatt and Hilton hotels, range from $129 to $189 per night. At the Gaylord's Rockies Resort and Convention Center in Aurora, rooms start at $324 per night. CSAB does not provide any financial assistance to board directors who serve smaller school districts or who do not receive any stipends. But Yenny said that there are different payment structures for members and non-members. The CASB website details costs for members to attend the convention from Thursday to Saturday. This cost includes some meals such as continental breakfast every day, some lunches, a networking luncheon, and reception. This is one of the premier education events for school boards. Superintendents also attend, Yenin said. From all the events that we have throughout the year, this is the one of the better events we have for learning for school leaders. Aurora lawmakers and censure action against council member during flagrant open meetings violation. A majority of Aurora City Council voted in private on Monday to dismiss a censure process pending against council member Danielle Jurinski, a vote that experts say was illegal under state transparency laws. Jurinski's attorney David Lane, as well as council members Allison Combs and Juan Marcano, all said the group decided to end the censure process in a closed session prior to the start of their March 14 regular meeting. According to Combs and Marcano, Mayor Mike Kaufman asked individual council members whether they supported the process continuing, and after a majority said they did not, the city attorney said the process would be formally halted. Steve Zansberg, a Denver attorney and president of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition, said the vote needed to have been public to be legitimate. The roll call vote of all city council members on whether they supported or opposed moving forward on the censure investigation is a flagrant, black and white, open and shut violation of the open meetings law, Zansberg wrote in an email. State law bars local public bodies from making such decisions in private, said the coalition's executive director, Jeff Roberts. He cited a statute that generally prohibits groups from adopting any proposed policy, position, resolution, rule, regulation, or formal action in closed session. Officially, the council convened the session to receive legal advice on specific legal questions, which is one of a handful of reasons for which local governments can legally meet in private. If they were going in there for legal advice, that's what it should have been for, to get answers to specific questions from their attorney, Robert said. They're not supposed to be making decisions in executive sessions. When asked how City Attorney Dan Brotzman's office would justify the council reaching its decision in executive session, City spokesman Ryan Luby wrote in an email Thursday that voting is not permitted in executive session, but council can and will provide direction to legal counsel. City staff cannot disclose attorney-client discussions, he wrote. However, outside legal counsel is handling this matter and is meeting with council member Jurinski's attorneys. We anticipate an update at Monday's study session. Courts across the nation have held that a public body must vote in public to provide direction to its attorneys about whether to file a lawsuit or an appeal, Zansberg said in his email. Directing the city attorney to terminate an active censure process is no different. Council rules also stipulate that while an executive session can be called to receive legal advice regarding the process of disciplining an elected official, no action or decision may occur in the executive session. Combs and Marcano both said Brotzman was present during the executive session and that the decision was reached after the mayor asked each individual council member whether they supported the censure process being halted. The topic of the censure did not come up during the portion of the March 14th meeting that was open to the public. Marcano initiated the censure process in late January after Jurinski insulted Police Chief Vanessa Wilson on a regional talk radio program and told listeners she believed Wilson and Deputy Chief Darren Parker should be removed from office. Jurinski also detailed a meeting with Wilson where she encouraged the chief to replace Parker. In response, Marcano accused Jurinski of violating a council regulation that requires members to act in a professional manner towards city staffers as well as a section of the charter that bars council members from meddling in the appointment of employees who fall under the authority of the city manager. Once Marcano formally started the process of censuring Jurinski, which would have had to earn the support of a majority of council members before the councilwoman faced any discipline, attorneys with Burns, Figa, and Will hired by the city started investigating and gathering evidence that could have been presented in a hearing on the topic. Lane warned in February that Jurinski would consider suing Marcano and the city if the censure process wasn't halted by March 4th, a deadline that was later extended to the 14th. On Monday, according to Combs and Marcano, Jurinski began arguing with the investigating attorneys and Brotzman before any of the evidence gathered could be presented. Jurinski did not respond to request for an interview on Thursday. Combs and Marcano said council members opposed to the censure characterized the process as a waste of taxpayer money. While Mayor Mike Kaufman at one point suggested the matter be discussed more at an upcoming study session, the two said he ultimately asked each member whether they thought the process should continue. All but Combs, Marcano, Ruben Medina, and Crystal Murillo said they did not, those present said. Marcano later called Monday's session a naked show of partisan corruption. I think this would have served a really good public purpose, he said of the council opting instead to decide on the censure in private. This whole thing was a clown show. It was effectively a roll call vote. It was a pretty bizarre meeting, Combs said. This turned into a purely political process. Marcano said the city is now working with Lane to settle the process, and that a letter of stipulation could be released Friday. According to Luby, Rotsman's office will present an update on the censure process at the Council City Council study session on Monday. It's Bodhi Day for Buddhists around the globe and in Aurora. By Luis Andres Henya, Associated Press. Buddhists around the world and here in Aurora are celebrating Bodhi Day. Also called Buddha's Enlightenment Day, it commemorates when Siddhartha Gautama attained awakening, or enlightenment, some 2,600 years ago, becoming the Buddha. When is Bodhi Day celebrated? Japan celebrates on December 8th, following the Western calendar. It varies elsewhere in East Asia, but generally the holiday falls between the winter solstice and the Lunar New Year, said Scott Mitchell, Dean of Students at Berkeley, California-based Institute of Buddhist Studies. Southeast Asian and Tibetan Buddhists celebrate Buddha's enlightenment in May and June, respectively, said Judith Simmer Brown, Professor Emeritus of Contemplative and Religious Studies at Colorado's Naropia University. How did Siddhartha Gautama achieve enlightenment? It happened after years of spiritual seeking and meditation, including gaining insights into the ultimate nature of existence. In particular, the origins of human suffering, the cycle of birth and death, samsara, and the path to liberation, nirvana, Manuel Lopez, a professor of Buddhist studies and religion at New College of Florida, said via email. Buddhism is regarded as the world's fourth largest religion after Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism. Most Buddhists live in the Asia-Pacific region. Which Buddhist traditions observe Bodhi Day? Not all Buddhists celebrate Bodhi Day. It is most common in East Asia's Buddhist Mahayana traditions found in Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. In Japan, Zen Buddhist schools, it is known as Rotasta, meaning the eighth day of the 12th month, Mitchell said. In some other schools, it is called Jodi. In Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, and other major Buddhist countries, it is celebrated as part of Vesak Day. Often in May, Vesak Day commemorates the birth, enlightenment, and death of the Buddha, Lopez said. How is Bodhi Day celebrated? Observances vary, but celebrants pray and read scriptures, sutras. Some decorate trees with colorful lights or candles, symbolizing Buddha's enlightenment, and have special family meals. Others engage in acts of kindness and generosity, dana, to reflect on the Buddha's teaching and improve their karma, Lopez said. Some eat rice and milk, believed to be the sustenance that helped Buddha make his final push for enlightenment. Tricycle, a Buddhism-focused magazine, writes in its online Buddhism for Beginners. What does Bodhi mean? Bodhi comes from a verb in Sanskrit and Pali that means to awaken or awakened. In Buddhism, it's generally understood to mean enlightenment. Siddhartha Gautama spent years seeking the answer to the problem of suffering. Finally, he attained awakening and became the Buddha while meditating under a peepal tree in Bodh Gaya, a village in the northeastern India state of Bihar. He was determined not to arise until he had solved the problem. Seated at the base of the Bodhi tree, facing east, he began a meditation that was to last through the night, said Philip Almond, emeritus professor at the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities at Australia's The University of Queensland. That night, he said, Gautama directly knew the true nature of suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. What is the Bodhi tree? The tree Gautama meditated under is called the Bodhi tree, or tree of awakening. As a result, the ficus leaf became a Buddhist symbol. Many Buddhists plant ficus trees. Today, Bodh Gaya and its Mahabodhi temple complex is one of the most sacred pilgrimage sites. The giant Bodhi tree near the main temple is believed to be a descendant of the original tree, according to UNESCO, says. El Tepehuan to close after 45 years in Inglewood. After 45 years of business at two different locations, Well-known Inglewood restaurant El Tepehan will close its doors on December 31st. Located at 3495 South Broadway, the building that houses El Tepehan and the business itself are being sold by owner Gracila Correll, who is retiring after running the restaurant for 36 years. Gracila's son, Miguel Correll, said El Tepehan first opened its doors in 1978 at a different location on Broadway, and his father, Jose Correll, was the original owner. Many still remember him fondly as he brought the warmth of Mexican culture and delicious Mexican food to Inglewood, Miguel said. In 1987, he passed away in a car accident, and that's when my mom took over. The Arapahoe County Assessor's website shows Graciela purchased the restaurant's current location in July 2014 and expanded the business. This year, my mom is retiring, and we're in the process of finishing selling the building, and my mom is in the process of talking to a potential buyer for the business itself, but that will be at a different location, Miguel said. Graciela told the Inglewood Herald during an interview where she spoke Spanish, translated by her son, that she knew it was her time to retire this year as she wants to spend more time and with family and friends. The business owner says she wanted to carry on the legacy of her late husband when she decided to take over the restaurant, and she has loved the community El Tepehan has built over the years. I love the pleasure of continuing to give good food to the community and being a presence in the community, Gracilia said. Being able to give work to other people, that also gave me personal joy to help other people out and the honor of achieving the American dream. Gracilia said that the last 36 years of her operation of the restaurant, the community response to El Tepehan has been positive and supportive. In general, the community has always been very supportive of the restaurant and very enthusiastic, Gracilia said. Regarding my retirement, it has definitely been a mixed response. She said some people are sad to see the restaurant close and will miss the food, but they are happy for her. However, Gracilia said others feel she can continue to run the business. It's a bittersweet kind of thing, Gracilia said. Miguel currently lives in California, but he said growing up in Inglewood with a mother who owned such a well-known business was interesting and inspirational. I think overall it really benefited me a lot, he said. So while growing up, it was just kind of cool to be with my mom, learning from her and seeing how she operated as a leader and manager, and kind of an influence to her employees. That really impacted me. Miguel works in business strategy. He said he has taken what he learned from his mother, such as how he thinks about people and business, and applied it to his own career. I have a degree in business, but she gave me my first education, Miguel said. Additionally, Miguel said the restaurant brought him a feeling of inclusion as he was able to be part of the Inglewood community. Gracilia's husband, David Davis, has also been a part of the operation of the current location. He said he and Gracilia met in 2006, and while she primarily ran the business, he assisted with some aspects of the current location, such as construction and technology. There's a little bit of me in this thing. I helped her during the pandemic, Davis said. Davis said he helped maintain the restaurant during the pandemic as Gracilia had to stay home due to health concerns. Davis said he too is ready for the next chapter of their lives. Gracilia said she is looking forward to traveling, spending time with family, and limiting her stress, but she will miss El Tepehan. I will miss everything. I will miss the customers. I will miss my employees, and I will miss just kind of having a place of community and sanctuary, Gracilia said. It does make me happy just being here. I will not miss the stress. Gracilia said she is grateful to the community for all its support for more than 3 decades. I am sorry to have to leave so soon. I am sorry for any small mistakes if a plate was sent back, but I am thankful for all the support, and whoever does buy El Tepehan will be there supporting them for many years, Gracilia said. Miguel said he is proud of his mom for successfully running the business for 36 years. We're talking about a woman-led business. A Latino-led business without even the equivalent of a high school education, and her English knowledge is limited. So that's something I've always found remarkable, Miguel said. Anytime I tell someone the story, they find it exceptional. It's a very rare thing to hear about and see it firsthand, so it's a big inspiration to me. Littleton Academy revived for 2024. In 2024, the Littleton Leadership Academy will give community members the opportunity to brainstorm big ideas, connect with other change makers, and develop as leaders. The program, born out of the Littleton Community Retreat, originally ran from 2017 until 2019 under the tutelage of former Littleton mayors Susan Thornton and Pat Kronenberger and former city council member Amy Conklin. When the pandemic began, the academy paused for a few years. In January, the program will restart under the leadership of Arapaho Community College, building on the tradition set by the founding women. We are keeping the intent to grow a cadre of community leaders, said Julie Biggs, who is leading the program at the college. To be able to have them have an opportunity to gain some skills and reflect upon how they want to make an impact, and truly be able to feel as if they are an active citizen within Littleton. The 10-month program will provide opportunities for people who live or work in Littleton to learn details about how the city works, from city government to education, and connect with others who are passionate about ambassadors for change in Littleton. Program details. Academy participants will meet monthly for a full day on the third Friday from January 2024 through October 2024. Meetings will take place throughout Littleton, from the college campus to the courthouse. Participants will learn about civic engagement and leadership styles from guest speakers, readings, podcasts, discussions, tours, and other experiential learning program approaches. During the program, participants will also develop a project plan for something they are passionate about that will help the community. Beyond the curriculum, Begg said, a valuable part of the program will be the connections formed. Our hope is that by being together for 10 months, they're going to get to know each other pretty well and can call on each other to support them in the work that they want to do, she said. Debbie Shackelford, a coordinator from the Littleton Leadership Academy, said she thinks one of the most valuable aspects will be the ability to develop individual leadership skills. I'm really looking forward to delivering a great experience for personal growth, leadership growth, she said. The very first day, within the first hour, they're going to say, I made the right decision. Who can participate? Several city council members, including Mayor Kyle Schlotchler, are past participants of the academy. Beyond official city positions, the program is intended to help people develop as leaders, Begg said. We want to continue to reimagine what it means to be a leader and for individuals to know that it doesn't just have to be an assigned title, she said, adding that the program is intended to be inclusive and represent an intergenerational and diverse group of community members. To apply for the program, community members must live or work in Littleton and be 18 or older. They should have a drive to tackle challenges facing the city and a history of volunteering or other civic engagement activities. Leaders and aspiring leaders from all sectors are welcome in the program, including corporate, nonprofit, government, education, and entrepreneurs. Shackelford said her team hopes to have about 15 to 20 participants this year. The program costs $500, which includes books, course materials, and lunch during each meeting. Costs can be covered by the individual participants or paid through an employer. Begg said scholarships are available for the program as well. A New Era. Thornton, Kronenberger, and Conklin said they are all happy Arapaho Community College is carrying the academy forward as they dedicate energy to serving the community in other ways. While anyone can participate in civic life, being a solid, forward-thinking leader requires some knowledge of many complex issues, Kronenberger wrote in an email to the Littleton Independent. This is especially true around the complicated interaction of land use, mobility, and housing. The community is better off with community leaders, elected and non-elected, who understand these complex issues. Conklin said the academy being part of the college may also give it more performance, recognition, and acknowledgement. For Beggs, carrying on the academy seems like a fitting thing for the college to do. It really is an opportunity for Arapahoe Community College to continue to be more engaged within the city of Littleton, she said. This just seems like a no-brainer for us, that we would be the place that would host an academy and continue to grow it and use resources that we have to help support the city that we love being part of. To learn more about the program and apply, visit https://www.arapahoe.edu/workforce-community-programs/littleton-leadership-academy. Applications will be open until the beginning of January. Inglewood to host job fair on December 14th. City planned event in response to the loss of 154 jobs by Elizabeth Slay. In response to the loss of 154 jobs upon the closing of Owry Sportswear LLC, Inglewood is hosting a job fair for those laid off on December 14th at the Inglewood Civic Center Community Room. Darren Hollingsworth, the Economic Development Manager, said the job fair is a response to one of the city's major employers closing its doors. Upon hearing word that Owry was closing this Inglewood facility, economic development staff contacted the team from Owry to see how we can be of assistance, and we worked together collaboratively with our economic partners to develop this job fair and support these employees, Hollingsworth said. Owry Sportswear President Connor Knutson announced the company was closing after 50 years in an August 18th letter to the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. The facility is located at 1201 West Mansfield Avenue and contains various machines and employees who work to create customized casual apparel and headwear to an ever-growing list of retail customers in the destination and resort, collegiate, golf, and corporate marketplaces, the company's website says. The company began laying off employees in October and will continue until the end of 2023, according to Knutson's letter. It is possible a few positions may continue into the first quarter of 2024. All affected employees have been notified of the plant closing, the letter said. Hollingsworth and Inglewood is partnering with the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment and Arapahoe Douglas Works Rapid Response Team to host the fair and provide information regarding other opportunities to dislocated workers. Many of these employees live in or around this community, and they will be looking for employment close to home, Hollingsworth said. In short, this event supports the dislocated employees and area businesses. Hollingsworth said there are various skill sets among those in the 154 dedicated employees, including production, warehouse, accounting, administration, management, and more. These skill sets are valuable in the marketplace, and local businesses need talent to grow, he said. So this event is actually supporting the growth of our existing business by helping to connect talent with local employees. Hollingsworth said a total of 8 employees have signed up to participate in the job fair, and he said the city believes most of the 154 former Owry employees will participate in the event. We hope this event benefits not only the workers and families impacted by the closure of Owry Sportswear in Inglewood, but also helps local employers seeking to fill vacant positions and grow their businesses, Hollingsworth said. Additionally, Hollingsworth said the city's economic development team is working with Owry and the owner of the property to backfill the commercial space and attract a new, vibrant community to our community, he said. The space is 114,000 square feet and is well suited for another large employer. Centennial Artists Collective aims to increase visibility through holiday market. In a bright studio speckled with color, the imaginations of local artists come to life along the streets at South Glen in Centennial. The space, located at 2154 East Commons Avenue in Suite 306, is operated by the So Sue Artist Collective, a group of seven women who create, sell, and teach art in its various forms. Whether it be pottery, paintings, textiles, or gel printmaking, there is something for everyone. I think all of us saw that there was a void in the south suburbs of art that needed to be filled, said Janet Moore, a founding member of the collective. We're making this our mission to fill that void. Now, in its fourth year of operation at the South Glen location, the collective hopes to bring greater visibility to its work. South Glen is struggling with all the stores closing, said Julie Wojcicki, a So Sue artist. We're trying to find ways to build more community. As part of its effort to make those community connections, the So Sue Artist Collective is hosting a holiday market through Saturday, opening up its studio for people to visit with the artist and purchase their innovative creations. Jill Mack, a So Sue artist, said that part of the collective's sales on Friday will go to the Graceful Community Cafe, a Littleton cafe that offers meals to anyone regardless of their ability to pay. I would love to see people come in on Friday, Mack said. Moore said that So Sue artists are in the studio every week making new art. For me, having the guests see the new work is going to be especially exciting, Moore said. Wojcicki, an artist who joined the collective around the time that the COVID-19 pandemic hit, said the studio primarily is a workspace for the artist, but they also host events and art classes in the studio. She said the studio does not have regular hours, but if an artist is working in the studio, they often open the doors for community members to come in. If a piece of art has a price tag on it, it is available for sale. Wojcicki said the artist will sell for one another when in the studio. People walking by the space will occasionally come in to watch the artist as they work. Mac, a folk artist who paints on recycled wood and joined the collective earlier this year, said that some kids once came into the studio while she was there and she asked them to pick out colors for her painting. They felt like they were part of the process, she said. Mac said that in the tough economic times that many community members face, people sometimes are less likely to purchase art. We offer great prices, she said, highlighting that the art pieces are handmade and one of a kind. Julie Vinciletia, a founding member of the collective, said she looks forward to teaching more in the future. I feel like when I teach, you're still learning new things, she said. That's the wonderful thing about teaching classes, especially in different art techniques. The art classes offered at the studio are different from others, the artist said. They offer participants a lot of choices on how they want their artwork to look, creating space for self-expression rather than everyone producing the same thing. So Sue is also open to doing private events and scheduling appointments for people to come visit the studio. For residents who want to stay up to date on what is happening in the studio and any upcoming events, the collective recommends following their Instagram account at So Sue Artists. The studio also has a mailing list visitors can sign up for, and residents can also email sosueartists@gmail.com. Wojcicki said being a part of the collective has been a joyful experience, saying it is nice to be around people who understand her. It's joyful to have a place to go, to do what brings me joy, she said. We build off each other and give each other ideas. Building on Wojcicki's point, Moore said, we're all on the same page because we understand the language of art. Max said the bright, uplifting studio is one of the things that drew her to the collective. I feel just such gratitude to have women that are so supportive and collaborative and want to build you up in your art as opposed to pull you down, Max said. It's just brilliant. The most recent addition to the collective is Sonia Fuentes, who joined around October. Fuentes said she lives nearby the studio and was always intrigued by the beautiful art she could see. When she learned there was an opening in the studio, she jumped at the opportunity to join. I am an aspiring artist, she said. Originally from Mexico City, Fuente said she wants to leverage her culture and combine it with more contemporary art. For example, she is interested in combining Mexican textiles with paintings, clay, and other art mediums. As she explores different art forms, she said she knows she can ask the other SOSU artists for help. It's supporting and empowering each other, she said. For Fuentes, art is an outlet that helps her connect with herself, and she wants to make art accessible to people in a way that is not intimidating. Everybody has talent. Everybody has creativity, she said. Wojcicki said that there is a place for everyone at SOSU, even those who think they cannot make art. I want people to know you can make so many beautiful things and have so much joy even if you think you can't, she said. Xcel Energy Transformer explodes near downtown Littleton. Updated at 4:40 p.m. on December 7th, an electrical transformer on an Xcel Energy pole near downtown Littleton exploded and briefly caught fire, startling neighbors in the area. The incident happened in the alley near Church Avenue and South Rapp Street. It caused a power outage in the area, and the fire quickly extinguished itself. Officials said no injuries were reported. The initial 911 call came in at 10:08 a.m. on December 7th, South Metro Fire Rescue spokesperson Eric Hurst said. It sounded pretty scary initially, Hurst said. The initial call was for an explosion and black smoke and flames coming from the roof of a building. But it was really just the person who called it in. Their perspective made it look like that was happening. The transformer caught fire, but it went out on its own and did not spread to any buildings, Hurst said. Hurst said by the time South Metro fire crews arrived, the fire and smoke were non-issues. The Arapahoe Community College Campus Police and Littleton Police Department also responded to the scene, Hurst said. Xcel Energy spokesperson Tyler Brandt said the power outage lasted from 10:07 a.m. until 11:53 a.m. and affected 36 customers in the area. The outage was due to an arrestor failure on the terminal pole, Bryant said. We appreciate our customers' patience as our crews work to restore electricity service as quickly and as safely as possible, he added. This article will be updated as more information becomes available. Castle Rock man pays $17,500 to scammer impersonating Douglas County Sheriff's deputy, by McKenna Hartford. After a day and a half of being threatened with arrest unless he transferred thousands of dollars, Brian Orr was out of money and believed he was going to jail. It was only after Orr sent $17,500 and as he was sitting in the parking lot of the Douglas County Sheriff's Office that the alleged deputy on the other end revealed the scam. Right when I was ready to give up, he says, "All right, Brian, how'd we do? 1 out of 10 or 10 out of 10? And I knew right then, Orr said. On November 29th, Orr received a call from a local phone number, and the caller claimed to be a Douglas County Sheriff's Office deputy. Orr said he was lulled into a false sense of security because the scammer took steps to seem legitimate and knew several details about him. The caller referenced Orr's loan information from the Personal Paycheck Protection Program, as well as his address, veteran status, and Social Security number. They told Orr he needed to transfer money because of an issue with Orr's PPP loan, or else he'd have a warrant out for his arrest and failed jail time. He had a stern professionalism, Orr said. All my safeties were off because I was focused on staying out of jail. The caller said the money served as a preemptive bond for Orr and would be refunded to him once the issue with his loan was sorted. Orr sent an initial payment of $3,000, but the scammer called back saying it wasn't enough and Orr needed to send more. I was filled with terror and panic, on the edge of tears for most of the time I was on the phone, he said. Thinking back, Orr said he wishes he would have hung up and called the sheriff's office to confirm the information. Orr filed a police report with the Castle Rock Police Department and a fraud report with his bank, but doesn't believe he will see any of his money again. A friend set up a GoFundMe to try and raise back the lost funds. Orr said he is sharing his story because he wants to prevent other people from becoming victims of scams like this. The reason why this is rampant in our country is because there's no one to stop them, he said. I hope people know they don't have to be silent when this happens. Douglas County Sheriff's Office spokesperson Kocha Hayden said Orr's story is not unique as scam calls impersonating officers and spoofing the office's phone number have been common for years but are becoming more sophisticated with new technology. Hayden said the scams often target the elderly but aren't limited to any age group or socioeconomic status. I think people get tricked by the sense of fear and urgency of the scams because many people don't deal with law enforcement, or if they do, it's in a positive manner, Hayden said. A December 5th post on Nextdoor from Castle Pine shared a story very similar to Orr's experience, where an alleged Douglas County officer called about a PPP loan. The poster determined it was a scam but wrote that the call was very convincing. Hayden said officers don't handle PPP loan-related concerns and will never call asking for payment over the phone. We may call people about a case or a warrant to say, this is how you take care of it, but we'll never, ever ask anyone to complete legitimate business by purchasing gift cards, using Bitcoin, or paying over the phone. Hayden encouraged people to ask questions or even hang up and call back through the office's non-emergency number to confirm whether a call is real. She said red flags for scam calls include asking for money, threats or fear-mongering, and a sense of urgency and secrecy. Once someone has been scammed, Hayden said it is often difficult to figure out who the scammer is or return any money that's been bilked, so the priority is prevention. She added that it's important to report scams so that law enforcement can educate others about them. Don't be embarrassed to report. We want people to call us so we can nip it in the bud, she said. It takes all of us to try and prevent these crimes through sharing information and citizens helping to spread the word. Foundation donates 200 bags of student supplies to Cherry Creek's mental health facility. By Taylor Shaw. Hoping to bring more awareness to a recently opened mental health facility for students, the Tuchman Family Foundation donated 200 bags of student supplies to Traverse Academy, located within the Cherry Creek School District. Traverse Academy is a first-of-its-kind mental health facility for Cherry Creek students aged 10 to 18 who are experiencing a mental health crisis such as suicide, ideation, depression, and or anxiety. The academy, operated by the school district, offers mental health care and educational programming to students with the ultimate goal of transitioning students back to their original home school. Wanting to support Traverse Academy, the Tuchman Family Foundation donated 100 welcome bags for students as they enter the facility, as well as 100 lunch bags for students as they leave the facility and transition back to their home school. It's our hope that we can help create awareness so that more people want to get involved and support this idea, and so that, ultimately, we have more of these types of academies throughout the state and throughout the nation, said Ken Tuchman, who founded the Tuchman Family Foundation with his wife, Deborah. Tuchman, who was also the founder and CEO of TTEC, a customer experience technology and services company, said the school district brought Traverse Academy to his and his wife's attention, and they toured the facility roughly 6 months ago while it was under construction. We were just blown away, he said. The Tuchman Family Foundation asked staff at Traverse Academy what materials they needed. We know how tight all these budgets are, Tuchman said. Anything that we can do to help these teachers so that these kids are more successful is really what matters to us. Courtney Throndson, an art teacher at Traverse Academy, said staff carefully selected the items for the bags to set students up for success. Some of the items in the bags are fidget tools, which can help students work out any restlessness or anxiety they feel, she said. To encourage mindfulness, items such as journals, aromatherapy, and mindfulness cards are added to bags as well, she said. The other focus was self-care and hygiene, Throndon said. The feeling of comfort in your body is incredibly important for mental health and wellness, so we included things like hygiene products, different clothing items, and self-care items. Throndon said she felt gratitude when she learned the Tuckman Family Foundation wanted to donate supplies to Traverse Academy. Prior to their initiative, we were trying to figure out what do we send them off with, and we didn't have the budget for that to be as impactful as the Tuckman Foundation is allowing us to be with this, she said. I'm really excited to be able to give them a toolbox of coping strategies to set them up for success. It really shows me how much the community wants to take care of our kids and their mental health, and that makes me really happy, too, she added. The contribution from the Tuckman Family Foundation gives hope to Kimberly Avalos, the principal of Traverse Academy. We felt extremely honored that the Tuckman Foundation was invested in us and wanted to do this for the kids, she said. The welcome and launch bags provide helpful tools for students as they work to improve their mental health, she said. Being able to understand that those tools don't just exist within these walls but can be used lifelong for them is a really important message we want to empower them with as they leave here, so they can continue that journey, Avalos said. Avalos said the foundation is helping send the message that the students matter and are worth the investment. The community support really helps us to get that message that not only is the school system investing, she said, but really, the community really does believe in us and really does want what's best for us. That's a pretty important message to send. Reflecting on Traverse's first 6 week. Traverse Academy, which has been open for about 6 weeks, has 12 students currently, with roughly another 20 students who are going through the intake process, Avalos said. We're learning a lot, she said. I think, on the whole, things have gone really, really well. The students currently at Traverse are either in middle school or high school. There are plans to open up the facility to students in fourth grade and up starting in January, she said. Avalos said Traverse's first group of students have gone through the intensive outpatient program and are getting ready to move to the faculty facilities transition program, which helps prepare them to go back to their home school. When asked about the biggest successes in the past 6 weeks, Avalos said, watching these kids come in very fragile states and start to take risks that they wouldn't have taken before, start to smile, start to communicate about their needs. A challenge has been navigating the differences between the clinical world and school world, she said. We're figuring out how to dance together, not step on each other's toes, but be complementary dance partners, Avalos said. Ken Tuckman of the Tuckman Family Foundation said he thinks that Traverse Academy is a model that should have started 10 years ago. I would argue that we need to have one of these in every community, he said. We don't have to educate the public that there's a mental health crisis. What we need to do is actually have a solution to a mental health crisis. This is one of many solutions, he added. Tuckman highlighted the importance of being proactive in investing in providing mental health care to young people. He said it is in the best interest of children, their families, and society as a whole to have children who are educated and in good mental state. Deborah Tuckman, a co-founder of the Tuckman Family Foundation, said a person's mental health and emotional well-being is as foundational as their heart beating. If a person is not feeling emotionally capable, they cannot learn, she said. She understands the value of Traverse Academy offering both mental health care as well as educational programming. I'm so hopeful to see this facility, she said. I think it'll be transformative for these kids. Supporting students' mental health. Traverse Academy serves a specific need within the mental health continuum, said Principal Kimberly Avalos. We have other things in our school district and other students who need access to different levels and different specialties within the continuum, she said. Avalos said the Cherry Creek Schools Foundation's Mental Health Relief Fund has been imperative to helping some students access care. That relief fund through the foundation is pivotal in helping to build a bridge for students that may otherwise have been lost in the shuffle or in the cracks, she said. According to Cherry Creek Schools, the Mental Health Relief Fund helps connect students to a therapist and provides resources for students experiencing different mental health challenges. The fund has given more than $100,000 to support student mental health initiatives in the school district, and approximately 48 students have been connected to an outside therapist, per the school district. Navigating health care is difficult, but mental health care is even harder to access and navigate, Avalos said. The community support in different initiatives and programs like this, it helps. It helps to build those bridges where they don't exist, she said. That's why the investment from the community is imperative. Those interested in learning more about Traverse Academy can visit cherrycreekschools.org/Traverse Academy. To learn more about the Cherry Creek Schools Foundation and its Mental Health Relief Fund, visit ccsdfoundation.org. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.